This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. When my guest Alfredo Corchado went to cover Mexico for the Dallas Morning News, he was determined not to focus on drugs and crime, but to cover issues critical to the country's future, immigration, education, and the economy. But it seems the drug cartels had other plans. Corchado spent years covering the savage violence of drug gangs and the corruption and ineptitude that enabled their reign of terror in much of the country. The story is particularly painful for Corchado, who was born in Mexico but grew up mostly in the U.S. in a family of California farm workers. He has family on both sides of the border now, and his new book is in part a memoir and in part the story of Mexico's struggle for peace and prosperity in an age of chaos. It's called Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Alfredo Corchado, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's begin with a moment, kind of in the middle of this story, 2005, and you go into a restaurant in Nuevo Laredo, the border town across from Laredo, Texas, with an old friend of yours, Ramon, who runs the newspaper in Nuevo Laredo. Just tell us a little about him, first of all, and what his newspaper has been through dealing with the drug cartels.
I had known Ramon for a few months, and he was had been going through, I guess, nightmarish experience. His brother had been kidnapped, released by members of organized crime. His editor had been killed. And Ramon needed someone on the U.S. side to kind of inform people what was going on, try to keep the story alive, because he was in the middle of what it's now called Zone of Silence. So in many ways, we became fast friends. I was trying to understand northeastern Mexico, what was happening in that region, and he was trying to reach out to an American correspondent.
Now, this was the time when there was a lot of violence. This particularly violent group, the Zetas, were operating in that area. And you mentioned that his brother was kidnapped. That actually brought him into direct contact with some cartels, and they made it clear what they expected him and his newspaper to do. You want to tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, Ramon had lived in that area for many years. I mean, he was born in Laredo and raised in Nuevo Laredo. And the Zetas, paramilitary group, had taken over the city. I guess to try to get their message across, they decided to kidnap his brother. The paper had a history of being one of the most independent papers in that region, and they were trying to find a way to get the message that there was a new law, if you will, in the city. So they picked up his brother, kidnapped him, and through an intermarry, Ramon was able to make contact with the leaders. They released the brother, and Ramon took this unusual step of saying, I want to come back to you. I want to sit down or talk and find out what you have in mind. I mean, what is it that you want? But I want my brother to be with me. So he picks up the brother. I think they met sometime around midnight. And the members of organized crime, the Zetas, were very, very clear. You know, we don't want you to investigate who we are. We don't want you to investigate our activities. We don't want the name Zetas in your stories. And from that moment on, Ramon basically obeyed them. He stuck to what they wanted. And so the paper went through this incredible transformation of being one of the most independent papers in the region to basically being silenced.
And this was at a time when you had been writing a lot of stories about, you know, the cartels, the drug violence. And you traveled to the region, and you met your friend Ramon, not on the Mexican side, but on the American side, in the town of Laredo at a restaurant. And tell us what happened.
Well, you know, at the time, it was really getting more and more difficult to meet on the Nuevo Laredo side. People were beginning to find refuge on the U.S. side. And it was a place called Agave Azul in Laredo, Texas. We had just sat. We're about to order when these guys come in, and they look like, to me, they look like gang members. And one of them takes his hand out, one of his right hand, and points at me and does what seemed to me like he was using a gun, bam, bam, bam. And I looked at him, and I didn't know whether that was a new greeting in Laredo. And I kind of looked at Ramon, and I said, what was that about? And he said, well, that's strange. The manager then comes up to us and says, you guys need to leave now. Ramon gets, you know, he gets really upset about that and says, what's going on? He says, you need to leave. And just by the sound of his voice, I thought, okay, this is urgent. So I said, look, let's just grab a burger somewhere else. Let's just leave. As we're leaving, a waiter comes over and, with some tequila shots and said, these are for you. I said, well, you must have the wrong person. We're about to leave. He says, no, they're from this guy at the corner. And the guy at the corner, I mean, I saw someone just walking, and suddenly there's this person's hand around my shoulder as though we were old friends. And he just starts, you know, telling me how great it is that that the Morning News is interested in covering Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, and isn't it a great town, and you know, there's so much activity going on. And I start kind of thinking, well, maybe this guy's with the Chamber of Commerce or the City Hall or something. And he says, you know, you get into problems when you start asking questions about the Zetas and who they are and how they operate and their ties to Texas and so forth. And we had been doing stories, I guess, for weeks at that point. And suddenly it just kind of felt like, you know, this was not a guy from the Chamber of Commerce. Ramon looks over and, you know, puts his hand on him and says, you know, okay, that's enough. Leave him alone. Says words in Spanish, you know, kind of some cuss words. And the guy just keeps insisting. He says, I'm just here to deliver a message. This is, you know, this comes from these guys, and you need to lay off. And here's what happens to people who don't listen to the message. And he describes in horrible detail how they, you know, take you, chop you to pieces, put you the pieces in acid. And he says, you know, the worst thing is that your mother might never know what happened to you. And the guy was just there for just, you know, a few minutes more and left, and that was it.
The interesting thing about this is that you're coming into Laredo, and they knew who you were, right?
I mean, they knew everything.
You weren't wearing a name tag, and they knew Alfredo Corchado and who he was and what he was doing.
You know, what was interesting is that they knew who I had met with that day. And one of them had been a federal agent.
And they referred to this in their conversation with you. So
right.
they had clearly been all over you.
Exactly. They said, it doesn't matter who's helping you, who's protecting you. Even that U.S. federal agent won't be able to do anything to help you. And it just kind of sucked, you know. I mean, I think the human intelligence that they have is amazing. I mean, I just looked at him like, wow. We are on the U.S. side of the border. I mean, we're in Texas, and it really makes you understand what transnational criminal groups can do or what they're capable of.
And there were a couple of times. I mean, you did get threatened more than once by the cartels, and there were a couple of times. I think you said that you left the country. Did you ever censor yourself at all, or as a result of any of that?
Never. I've never censored myself. I think, you know, what's interesting is how the paper has reacted. I mean, the newspaper reacted to protecting and making sure that we continue telling the story. I mean, at some point they put other reporters on particular stories to make sure that the cartels understood that this was not personal. We were just doing journalism. But given what the situation is with our Mexican colleagues, I mean, our situation pales in comparison. These guys have no protection. You hear the stories, and the last thing you ever want to do is censor yourself or become silent like they have. So you keep telling the stories because it's the stories that have to be told. It's a historic time in Mexico. It's a transformative time in Mexico. And I think it also speaks to the power of journalism.
Right. And we should note that, 70 Mexican journalists have been murdered over the course of all this.
Depends on the numbers. Sometimes some people say it's 45. Other people say it's more than 100. What we can say is there are regions in Mexico where cartels are in control and they become zones of silence.
You know, the book is in part a story of some of the harrowing experiences you have covering the cartels, but also sort of a story of Mexico and a prayer for progress. And you know, there was a big change in 2000 when the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which had been in control for decades, was finally overturned, and a new president, Vicente Fox, of a rival party, comes to power. drug violence grows rather than lessening. The endemic corruption still seems to be there. And you describe in 2003 going to investigate some disappearance and murders of young women in Juarez. Or tell us a little bit about that trip, that investigation.
Sure. I mean, I think Juarez really became the key to understanding what was happening to Mexico, if you will. This was 2003, and the paper wanted to kind of get into who was killing so many women in Juarez. I think at the time there was more than 100 women had been killed in over 10 years. There were signs that maybe there was a serial killer involved. We didn't know. I mean, as typical in Mexico, you never really know because there aren't very credible investigations. There's always impunity involved. So they, for some reason, you know, I look back now and I kind of laugh because I think the paper really thought I could get to the bottom of this. And they said, look, it doesn't matter the time you spent. Just let's try to get some real answers. And it became very clear to me that with the election of Fox, you had the central power, if you will, suddenly it moves to the state levels. And so suddenly these governors become little fiefdom leaders. And you see the mess. I mean, you see the mess evolving before your eyes. It was interesting coming to the women of Juarez because you saw how investigators were just, you know, just doing rookie mistakes with some of the investigations, some of the evidence they collected, and so forth. And that's, I think, when I started thinking this is not going to end well.
Well, so you said you kind of laugh when you think that the newspaper was thought you were going to go and solve this investigation. But what did you find? What did you find out about this pattern of these young women being missing and then found murdered?
I think I found a lot more questions than answers. I mean, there were some indications that some of the women were victims of organized crime. One person I met, a lawyer, kind of helped me understand, you know, that there was a group called La Línea, and we started using that word even before, I think, the local media or before anyone else did. A group called La Línea, who were part of the Juarez cartel, and they were, in effect, they were so powerful they could just decide what to do, who to do, who to kill, etc. And according to this one theory, they would target certain women of certain age, of certain build, etc. And they would have parties, and they bring the women forcibly, and then they have sex orgies, etc. And after a while, they would just discard them. But at the same time,
you're talking about gang rapes. You're not talking about anything consensual.
Exactly, gang rapes. At the same time, I mean, you had a lot of other cases that it seemed to be much more domestic situations. But the frustrating thing, you know, going back to Mexico's impunity, is that you could never really get to the bottom of, you know, even one murder. I mean, there was always questions about this, questions about that. And it just, I think it made me understand just how weak the institutions were in Mexico and how, I mean, it's a country with all these great laws in the books, but really no rule of law, or at least a very weak rule of law.
Throughout all these years, I mean, the cartels get stronger, the violence increases, and then we have a new president in 2006, Felipe Calderón. And you, as you watched him prepare to take office, I mean, you interviewed these guys. You were in Mexico City. You knew them well. And you write that at some point when you saw Calderón looking at the violence and just what a serious threat it proposed, you said you wrote down in your notebook, he gets it. What was different?
I did. I mean, going back to 2005 with Ramón and Nuevo Laredo and seeing these paramilitary leaders take over a town, and you see how these communities were just crumbling slowly, and you kept questioning, why isn't Vicente Fox doing more? Why isn't the president doing more? There was a time when even President Fox would call our people at the Dallas Morning News and question why we were so determined with the story. Why were we so obsessed when really it was just part of the whole democratic thing in Mexico? So when Felipe Calderón comes in and he's very clear, and you kind of see this determination in him. I remember it was September, a few months before he took office, and I just thought, this guy really has the courage to stand up and realize, you know, what the problem is in Mexico, and he's going to do something about it. I mean, that was the moment, you know. And in hindsight, you can question a lot of things, and I think, you know, it remains a debate whether he used the right strategy. I mean, here we are, 6 years later, more than 100,000 people either kill or disappear. So there's a lot to debate, a lot to question.
Right. So you have here a situation in which the cartels, some of them had become paramilitary organizations. I mean, they had heavy weaponry, you know, and ballistics vests and helmets in some cases. And so he brings in the military. He's going to match power with power, and he's determined. What happens? Why doesn't it work?
I think the corruption inside. I mean, I look back now. I mean, hindsight. Here we are again. You know, Monday morning quarterbacking, and I often ask myself, you know, what happened? And I think it really shows just how much corruption permeated every institution in Mexico, especially law enforcement. I remember talking to a U.S. source who said, you know, you give these guys the intelligence, you give them files of intelligence, and within seconds, if not minutes, the enemy knows what you're doing. I mean, they have all the information. And I think that was a real chilling example of what went wrong. I talked to Mexican officials later I've asked them, you know, what happened? And they tell you, we thought we had everything planned. And then you march up the hill and you realize you're not on a horse, but you're on a donkey. You look around you and there's not, you know, the cavalry's going in different directions. I think that kind of sums up the Calderón years.
You know, that was an evocative quote that you said in the book. What did the guy mean, the cavalry's going in the other direction, we're riding donkeys?
There was no planning. There was no real strategy. There was no real trust within the agencies. I mean, all of a sudden, all these agencies who, at one point, you know, he explained, you know, you had one agency, the federal police, you had the attorney general's office. They were all split. Some of them had taken sides with one cartel over the other. And suddenly, within weeks, if not months, you were trying to force them to take on cartels. The cavalry was not, they were all going in different directions. I mean, everybody kind of had their own loyalties.
All right. So the intelligence you need, for example, to go and arrest a leader is no good because the leader gets tipped off. And then the people who have to build the cases, the prosecutors, they're on somebody's side. They fall apart. So in effect, did things get worse with the offensive?
You know, I've gone back and forth with officials on both sides of the border, and they say, you know, it's easy to criticize Calderón now, but the way the country was moving, we also have to question, we were on the verge of becoming a narco state. Did we do the right thing? I think it'll take years for people to really get an answer on that. I mean, but then again, what do you tell people who lost a loved one or loved ones are disappeared? I mean, it's a tough question for Mexico, and I think the country's trying to go through this soul-searching, if you will. You know, was it worth it? Was what happened with Calderón? And this is really an important time for Mexico to do that because, you know, the PRI is back, the regime that governed Mexico for 71 years. So I think it's really testing Mexicans like never before. And it's testing to see just how far they've come as a civil society. How much can they keep the government accountable? And the question really is, will this country really become a better country in the future? Will Mexico really prosper? Will Mexico really become a nation of laws?
Has the violence subsided at all? I mean, have some of the big kingpins been arrested?
None. I mean, that's what's so chilling and that's what's so troubling today is you have the new administration talk about how things have gotten better. The violence, some say, has gotten down, you know, by 14%. Yeah, you talk to independent analysts and they question whether maybe they're using different criteria. Some of the same killings are still happening. You know, you find five heads, six heads, seven bodies dangling. It's just not getting the same kind of coverage or the same kind of attention that it did in the last 6 years. But I think the violence overall is pretty much the same. Does it mean that that we shouldn't be covering other stories? You know, the I guess maybe the more prosperous side of Mexico. No, but you can't cancel one story over the other.
I want to talk a little bit about your life. You were born in Mexico. Tell us about the village, what your life was there when you were young.
I was born in a small little town called San Luis de Cordero, Durango, not very far from, I guess the biggest city is Gomez Palacio, bordering the state of Chihuahua, northern part of the state. About 2,000 people, roughly, mostly farmers, people who grown corn, and a lot of, I think the majority of the men would spend their time in the United States. This was during the program of the braceros, the guest worker program. So you had men who would were only there maybe 2-3 months out of the year, spend most of their time in Texas, Arizona, and California. My father spent most of his life in the San Joaquin Valley. But it was a pretty good life because we had continuous money coming from the north. It was a very comfortable life. It was a very good life.
Yeah, you write that even at that young age, you knew you didn't want to go to the United States. But your family decided, and partly because there was a tragedy in your family. You had a sister who drowned. But you made your way to the fields of California. You grew up in a trailer there for a lot of years, right? Now, were you actually working the fields with your parents, or were you going to school? What was your life like then?
We lived in the trailer house for a few months, and then we left another camping grounds, if you will, owned by ranchers throughout the San Joaquin Valley. And yes, we were working in the fields. I think I was maybe six, seven when I started working in the fields, tomatoes, picking oranges. And it's not as horrible as it sounds. I mean, it was not, you know, child labor. It was actually kind of a fun time because you were all around family all the time, or you were around friends all the time. And I think at that age, when you're trying to make the transition from Mexico to the United States, it was important to feel that kind of support, that kind of help around you. But yes, for at least the first 10, 12 years in California, I mean, we worked in the fields. We worked as farm workers. My parents were members of the United Farm Workers, which was the head was Cesar Chavez. So it was that kind of experience, you know, feel and then school during the school year.
What kind of a future did you see for yourself?
The fields. I really thought that, you know, I had made it. I thought I knew some English. I thought I was in love with the one of the rancher's daughters, and I thought, you know, this is the easy way out. I will someday be the mero or the supervisor, because all I saw around me were other Mexican American kids who ended up in the fields. It didn't matter how educated they were. It didn't matter how smart they were.
The mero, that's an expression meaning what? The big guy, right?
The big guy, right?
Right, right. You're in the fields of California. I mean, living with your family, going to public school. You dropped out of high school, but you end up as a journalist and a respected one. How did you get there?
Well, I ended up at El Paso Community College and ended up studying journalism later at the University of Texas at El Paso, and covering Mexico, which is right across El Paso, I mean, covering Ciudad Juarez. Eventually, I end up becoming the bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News based in Mexico City. And part of my job is really covering the whole country, you know, Mexico itself, but also the U.S.-Mexico border. So there's always a lot of crisscrossing the border. One day you may be in El Paso, or you may be in Dallas, or Laredo, and then suddenly you're in Mexico, Mexico City, Coahuila, Durango, etc.
Now, I want to clarify one thing about your personal story. You were born in Mexico, spent a lot of time in the States. Are you an American citizen?
I'm an American citizen now. Back, I think, more than 20 years now.
So did you just go through the naturalization process?
Yeah. Naturalization. I was working at the time at the Wall Street Journal, and I told my editor someday I want to work as a foreign correspondent. And he said, look, the first thing you got to do is become a U.S. citizen.
Right, which because now you have after that you have a U.S. passport, and it comes up at times when you get into these tough situations in Mexico. You're an American journalist, you know, covering Mexico, but you don't exactly look like an American. I mean, did you have the protection that other American journalists have?
I do, and I don't. I mean, a source of mine once said, I once asked him, you know, how likely is it that a drug cartel would target an American journalist, and he said, he says, look, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that cartels do not want to mess with Americans because it messes, it gets in the way of their billion-dollar industry. Bad news is that you just don't look American. And that really hit me hard. I mean, he's right, but it kind of made you question, you know, what exactly is an American?
You know, the book is about your life as a journalist, but also about your life. And you, while you're reporting in Mexico and, you know, north of the border, you have family in El Paso, relatives in Mexico. And there are a number of moments in which, you know, the terrible violence that the country's experiencing directly impacts friends and family. And I want you to tell me about when your uncle Delfino dies in Ciudad Juarez and the experience of his death and burial in when that city was going through such terrible violence.
You know, Dave, the book in many ways is my effort to try to answer my mother's question, you know, which is why would you want to go back to Mexico when we did so much to sacrifice to leave Mexico? She sacrificed her love for the homeland, etc. And my uncle Delfino, as a child, was really, I mean, he was like a father figure to me. I didn't really know I had a father because he was gone to work in California for so much part of the years. So my uncle Delfino always felt that there was another side to Mexico that people didn't understand, you know, the generosity of his people and the potential of the country. And there was something that as a child I think really marked me when I left Mexico. It was at his funeral when he died of a heart attack. He was getting off the bus, and what was horrible was that this was during Juarez's most dreadful days. He dies, and people kind of looked at another body on the ground and didn't really go there to try to help him. I mean, you know, just another body. And he, the day of his burial. I mean, first of all, there were so many corpses at the morgue that they couldn't keep him anymore. So they brought him earlier. My uncle's body lay out in the sun. I mean, August somewhere, El Paso, Juarez sun, the worst.
You know, in under normal circumstances, the body would have remained at the morgue. It would have been kept refrigerated until the family was ready to assemble the burial. In this case, what, they simply bring you the body and say, sorry, you're going to have to take it now?
Sorry, there are too many bodies. You're going to have to take it now. And we're sorry that you're waiting for your loved ones to come back from California and Mexico and Colorado. But, it's, you know, this is the new reality in Juarez. So my cousin did the next best thing. I mean, she put a fan over the body, over the coffin, you know, to try to keep it fresh. And I showed up and just went up to the coffin. And I mean, I still get emotional thinking about it because it was like a conversation with my uncle, you know, Tio Delfino, was this the Mexico you so believed in? And the day of the burial, on the way to the church, there was a shooting outside some store right across the church. And next thing I know, I mean, there were military people and there were people with guns, you know, pointing at you and pointing at the whole procession. My instinct was to try to get my camera, and I started taking pictures. And then suddenly there was a gun, you know, just pointed, I mean, directed at you. And it was like another day for them. We continued on to the cemetery. The guy carrying the casket kept looking at his watch and finally comes up to me and says, look, we have to leave. I have to leave. There's so much, you know, so many killings in Juarez that they need my services. We have to move, keep moving bodies, etc. And I looked at him and I said, you know, in my uncle's honor, can you just stay for a couple of minutes and I'll find a way to get someone else to help us lower the body and bury my uncle. He kept looking at his watch. I finally walked up to him. I said, you can leave. Two other people have stepped in and said, you know, we'll help you. So we have family members and bureau guys help us put the body down, and we put dirt over him. And, you know, it was a very sad moment, but at the same time, and we couldn't wait to just leave Juarez, which was very sad because a lot of family had come from California and Colorado, and they just couldn't wait to get back to the U.S. side of the border.
So there you were in, you know, surrounded by these military activities, and it just didn't feel safe to do what every family does when someone dies, which is to stay and share memories.
I kept, you know, just listening to the sirens that were outside and all the other people burying loved ones. I mean, I couldn't tell whether people, I mean, they were victims of violence and so forth, but there was just so much death around you. And one thing that this guy had told me, the guy who carried my uncle's casket, he said, you know, the only business these days, the only business that's growing are funeral homes. And people are talking about expanding cemeteries because we're running out of space. I think that was one of the saddest things I heard that day.
As somebody who's worked for years as a journalist covering government in the United States, I mean, I'm so impressed with what you were doing there in Mexico. But it also made me wonder, you know, there's a tradition of the investigative journalist that, they, you know, muckraking brings change. You know, you expose environmental pollution or unsanitary, you know, food packaging, and that leads to more regulation or inspection. Or you find a local official who's corrupt and they are indicted or they resign and reform results. I have to say, when I read about some of the experiences in Mexico, the corruption seems so deeply endemic that it almost feels like you risk your life and go to write stories, and people read them and say, "Yeah, I already knew that. I already knew that there was no justice. That the authorities are in with the criminals." And I wonder if it ever just feels futile.
There are times when I ask myself that question a lot. I mean, but I got to tell you, I mean, I think sometimes covering Mexico is really like covering two or three countries. I mean, there are those regions in Mexico where, you know, there's silence. I mean, there's nothing being reported, or people depend on social media to get news. But there's also, I think, in other parts like Mexico City, Guadalajara, Monterrey, where there's a lot more aggressive investigative journalism. I mean, one of the Pulitzer winners this year is Alejandra Chanik, a freelance reporter in Mexico City who helped the New York Times win another Pulitzer by helping uncover the whole corruption in Walmart. And it was during her, you know, this investigation that I think a lot of Mexicans, I think it really opened a lot of eyes to people and really made them understand that there was so much more to do, and that, yes, there was a lot of cynicism, a lot of, you know, what we do, does it really matter? Do people already, you know, people know about the corruption? But I think when you start putting names and you start putting faces, I mean, to what seems at times to be ghosts, I think it really changes the way people think about things. And I think that's it. It's also a homage to our profession as journalists. I go from a Mexico City where there's, you know, people beginning to take whole government accountable to a place in Nuevo Laredo where people don't know much about upcoming elections or about what happened, why 3-4 bodies appear. And you see the difference, and you, I think, respect and understand the value of journalism that much more.
How do you feel about Mexico's future?
I remain hopeful. I mean, I really remain hopeful. I think if you look at Mexico in the last 6 weeks or the last 6 days or the last 6 years, you tend to get depressed and that whole dread thing comes in. But when I look at Mexico over the last 20 years and I see a much more open society, I see a press trying to hold government accountable, I see government officials, you know, on radio shows, on newspapers, on TV, giving their explanations. You see competition with political parties. It gives me hope for the country. I mean, you know, the whole name Midnight in Mexico, I mean, I had to explain that to my mother. Like, you know, why would you name your book Midnight in Mexico when really what you want to do is talk about the possibility? I said, Mom, during the darkest moment of the night, it's when you're looking for that crack of light. You're looking for that flickering light. And you believe in the promise of a new day. And that's why I remain hopeful about Mexico. I think there are better days that will come. But here's the deal. You know, is it going to happen in my lifetime? I'm not so sure. But I think things are changing. I think things are moving.
Your family's changed, too. You know, you were born in Mexico and then, of course, lived in California, working the fields, ended up in El Paso. Now you work for a Dallas newspaper covering Mexico, living mostly in Mexico. And there's a scene where you describe a big family gathering, I guess it's in El Paso, and a lot of members of your extended family are speaking English, and their Spanish isn't so good. Where are you? What's your identity?
My identity is, I think, that's a great question, Dave. I have the Mexican heart, but I think I have the American brain. And I think that's how I try to write this book, you know. You feel with one and you think with the other. And my family, I think it's a timeless tradition of the United States, you know, the whole immigrant experience where suddenly you look around and you listen and the only Spanish you hear is when your parents speak Spanish. Everyone else has become so assimilated that English becomes the dominant language. And I keep reminding them, you know, Mexico isn't going anywhere. Whether you're Asian, whether you're African-American, whether you're Mexican, whether you want to embrace your roots or not embrace your roots, Mexico isn't going anywhere. It's 2,000 miles along the border. It's right there. The music we eat, we listen to, the food we eat, the gas in our gas tanks, the cars we drive, it's increasingly Mexico. And you know, we have to kind of come to some kind of reconciliation over that. I mean, I always think about this book as you know, love for the homeland, love for the family, redefining who you are, you know, reinventing ourselves. And I think as immigrants, we can continue to reinvent ourselves when we're on the U.S. side of the border. But it's also reconciliation among the Mexicans in Mexico, but also Americans on this side of the border and Mexico itself.
Well, Alfredo Corchado, thanks so much for speaking with us.
David, it was my pleasure.
Alfredo Corchado has spent years covering drug violence and the efforts to stem it in Mexico as the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. His new book is Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness.